You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on Alzheimer's disease hosted by Med Learning Group. This two-part series is titled Engaging Patients, Caregivers, and Multidisciplinary Providers in the Shared Goal of Facilitating an Earlier Alzheimer's Disease Diagnosis and Optimizing the Use of Anti-Amyloid Therapies. The program is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage Alzheimer's disease, including neurologists, geriatricians, psychiatrists, advanced practice providers, and other clinicians in both academic and community settings. In this episode, we'll be talking about recent developments in diagnosis and evaluation of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, and some of the implications in clinical practice. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Alireza Atri, Chief Medical Officer of Banner Research, Alzheimer's Research Institutes in Phoenix and Tucson, Arizona, and Director of the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Sun City, Arizona. Dr. Atri has long been involved in the management of patients with Alzheimer's disease, and he's also lead author on recent diagnostic guidelines for Alzheimer's disease and has participated all over the world in educational events on Alzheimer's disease for many years. Dr. Atri, great to be speaking with you today.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate being here today.
So I know I gave you a brief introduction there, but briefly introduce yourself. How long have you been a caregiver for patients with Alzheimer's disease, and how did you end up involved in this field?
I've been a cognitive neurologist taking care of patients and families for almost 25 years, but really my first experiences were personal. I have this running on both sides of the family, unfortunately. So on my dad's side, his mother, older sister, brother, and then on my mom's side, her sister, who was like a mother to her and lived with us, we took care of her at home, and that was really, really tough, I think, you know, for me going through that. And then later on, when I was a subspecialist already, my dad came down with it and lived with us, and we took care of him at home for over 10 years. So, you know, the line between being a clinician and being a patient or a caregiver or a care partner is kind of imaginary. Yep. For all of us. Very few of us are going to escape this. So yeah, it's been a privilege and I've learned a lot from it.
Well, I know over your career, you've become a thought leader in this area. So thanks for all you do in this area. And we're really fortunate to have you on today. Now, I wanted to focus today's discussion on the evaluation and diagnosis of the various stages of cognitive impairment. So I guess let's start there. Where are we now with staging cognitive impairment on the Alzheimer's disease spectrum?
Yeah, I think we've had some conceptual advances thinking about the clinical stages and the syndromes differently from the diseases. One of the major sort of advances is sort of acknowledging that the biology of Alzheimer's disease does start 20, 25 years before people have symptoms. So one of the new proposals, and I can talk to you a little bit about the staging both clinically and then as you would like for the disease. The evolution has been with the biomarkers, we can actually measure these processes while people are alive. And neuropathology, the tissue that we get, you know, gives us confirmation. So one of the new concepts in the diagnosis staging of Alzheimer's disease is that people who don't have symptoms can actually have Alzheimer's disease. And that's the proposal by the Alzheimer's Association. Kind of in the same way you can think of lung cancer. You know, one doesn't have to have shortness of breath and coughing up blood to say, oh gosh, well, we can't diagnose you yet until you have symptoms. The proposal is that we can actually diagnose, you know, amyloid and tangles with biomarkers before. And then people can progress through a multitude of symptoms. Some people are at stage zero, where they may have the biology from a dominant gene or have trisomy 21, but without symptoms. And then, you know, nobody wakes up one day and says, gosh, today I have my kind of impairment. That's the equivalent of what they call stage three clinically now. You know, years before that, people may go through a progression where they're essentially normal. Some people many people will actually feel something has changed. They may be scoring lower on tests. So the spectrum, once the biology is established, ranges from what they call, you know, stage zero to six. And really three and four are the MCI stage and the mild dementia stages. And those are the stages currently that, we've just developed and approved disease-modifying drugs for. And really the line between MCI, mild cognitive impairment as a construct, and mild dementia really is the line between someone essentially being independent on their activities. It doesn't mean they can't be slow, not, you know, do compensatory strategies, or the line where they are become dependent. So that's the staging part for clinically. And then there's the biological staging that is also being proposed. Now, having said that, some other groups say, you know what, you know, maybe Alzheimer's disease is a little bit more like prostate cancer, where you can have the biology, but, you know, in older people, and you don't know exactly when people or a given person is going to show symptoms. And that's true also. We're learning a lot. So some international working groups are saying, well, you know, if you have the biology, we'll call you at risk, but you have to have the symptoms to have you call the disease itself. I think it's a matter of semantics. What it allows us to appreciate is that if you have the biology, even if you don't have symptoms, you're at much higher risk. And then as the staging of the biology increases, for example, just not just from having plaques, but having tangles, and having the tangles, which are like a fire spreading from the temporal lobe into the neocortex, then most longitudinal studies suggest that people will start developing symptoms within years.
To back up, it seems like there's been more and more biomarkers that have evolved over the past several years. You were an author on some of the revised staging and some of the Alzheimer's Association guidelines for that. What is the actual biomarker staging in comparison to the clinical staging?
Yeah, the biomarker staging is really a conceptual framework that has been used for research, but now it's dipping its toes into clinical practice because we finally have some of the biomarkers that are both FDA approved and being paid for. That's really the important part. So spinal fluid is one of them. We can measure amyloid and features of tau. So there's definitely AD patterns that we can measure. There's also PET scans, amyloid PET scans and tau PET scans that are that some of the Ligands are FDA approved. And the amyloid PET is now being paid for by most insurance, including Medicare. And then the blood biomarkers are really new. And one was just FDA cleared just about a month ago. And again, the question is reimbursement, you know, sensitivity, specificity, and then especially what we think of positive and negative predictive values. Those are independent of, the test sensitivity, specificity. They have to be done in a certain population to give us an answer. So we're working some of those things out. They are all going to trickle into care. And you alluded to, you know, one of the guidelines. So after 7 years, we've developed guidelines for the Alzheimer's Association. It's a multidisciplinary group that's meant to look at primary care, specialty care, and subspecialty care, and really put down the foundations of what should be an evaluation process that includes biomarkers, that's evidence-based. So it took us 7 years, almost 10,000 reviews of papers. It was a PCOTS, Institute of Medicine, sort of development. And we put a framework together and through 19 recommendations about, you know, how to proceed with that workup and when to bring the biomarkers in, when you want to improve your confidence, how to use, you know, neuropsychological assessments, who to refer faster, what's first tier, what's second tier, what's third tier, what's generally can be done and should be done in primary care, what's reserved for specialty care.
So with the Alzheimer's Association guidelines, we have the tiered testing, tiers 1 through 4, and then tier X. But with the guidelines you set forth as lead author on last year, there's core 1 through 7 criteria for evaluation. How does the tiered testing fit in with those 7 core elements?
Right. Yeah. So these are all, by the way, these are, if one goes, puts in Alzheimer's and Dementia Journal, and you can go in there and there's a special edition that's free to upload. There are multiple executive summaries, primary care, specialty care, there are instruments there. It's all available. And the idea was once you do an evidence review, you put it in the framework of recommendations. And so the recommendations, there were 19 of them, again, including, you know, what's the order of things to do in a process. And the cores you mentioned are basically, you know, structured in a way that map on to the recommendations. So the first core really is getting buy-in from the patient and a care partner. Being aligned about what the goals of an evaluation are. I mean, without that, it's going to be very, very difficult. And then there's a step process that the cores go through, you know, elements of history, review of symptoms, and all to bring you to basically answer three basic questions. One is, you know, is something wrong, right? And if something is wrong, and how confident, you know, you are as a clinician for that, at what level? Is it really, here's somebody that has subjective cognitive concerns, or is this really MCI level of potential impairment or mild dementia level? And then the second question would be, what is the pattern? So what elements are involved? So everybody says, oh, it's my memory. But once you actually do the testing or do a review of systems, it actually may not be memory. It could be attention. It could be word finding, right? So having that pattern also helps for a couple of things. One, etiology, which is the, really the what you're trying to drive at. And the other one is, what supports do patients need, right? So it really matters, you know, if somebody who is has difficulty with language needs different supports than somebody who has really poor judgment and bad memory, right? And then the third question is, what biomarkers and what testing can you do to nail down as much as possible the etiology, the primary driver, and the contributing factors? So someone could have Alzheimer's changes in the brain, but actually, you know what? The driver for them may be sleep apnea and they're drinking too much and they're taking diphenhydramine at night. So teasing those things out are important. And then you mentioned the tier testing. So the tier testing really tell us the order of tests. So for example, a tier one and a tier two test are things that commonly can be done and should be done and would, for most people, would improve outcomes in primary care, involving cognitive lab panel and actually a brain MRI. Before that, really, insurance companies could say, oh, there's no standard of care, and sometimes could deny. And then saying that, for example, things like in tier two are only added on in the primary care or specialty care setting when there's more suggestion that they could be involved. Like RPR for syphilis isn't done routinely anymore. And then we're thinking of tier three and tier four and emerging tier X as things that really are, should be in the hands of the specialist and subspecialist because they require nuanced interpretation and really proficiency. And those are a lot of the biomarkers now for Alzheimer's disease, including, you know, CSF, PET, you know, the emerging blood biomarkers, you know, alpha-synuclein skin tests or CSF tests, you know, FDG PET, you know, things like that.
So we've discussed biomarkers at length, blood-based, CSF, imaging biomarkers. Where do the in-office testing instruments fit in for evaluation? The mini mental state exam, Montreal Cognitive Assessment, et cetera?
Yeah, they're very important. And there's a recommendation that at every setting, whether it's primary care, you know, specialty care, subspecialty care, there should be validated instruments that are used that, you know, that assess, you know, cognitive performance in that time. And then we have a list, actually, in one of the executive summaries, we have lists of what's available, whether it's the MoCA, the pros and cons, for example, how long it takes. There are links for even for specialty care, for other instruments. But really, you know, after doing a formal interview and a structured review of system of, you know, aspects of cognition, daily function, behavior, motor symptoms, looking at risk factors, medications. Really, the next step is to use a kind of assessment that's validated and, you know, along with whatever, you know, you want to do in addition. And, you know, take that along with that particular person's past history to come up with an assessment of whether one thinks there's potential kind of impairment or not. So those are things that are recommended. And we appreciate, I think, you know, the work group was comprised not just of kinds of neurologists. We had geriatricians, primary care clinicians, neuropsychologists, nurse practitioners. We appreciate that in primary care, it's very, very difficult to do this in one visit. It's actually impossible, I think. So, you know, we suggest strategies about, you know, after gaining alignment, you know, breaking up the visit into potentially multiple visits. But certainly a kind of assessment using an instrument is a really important part of that. And then, of course, there's tiered testing for etiology.
So you alluded to primary care, just kind of as we conclude here and kind of putting everything together. Maybe just summarize a few of the best practices for specialty diagnosis and assessment versus what a primary care clinician would do.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the guidelines was giving sort of the knowledge and the tools for primary and specialty care to be empowered to actually, use these and ask for these, for these tools and have it be reimbursed. So in primary care, there's an acknowledgement that a fair bit can be done, but, they're limited in time. So there are elements of the workup, including, getting the alignment, getting the cognitive tests like a MoCA done, for example, having the tier one tests and potentially selected tier two tests done, having the MRI done, when to refer, for example, to potential neuropsychological evaluation or a specialist. Those pathways are all suggested and recommended. And of course, the specialist has to do a deeper dive in really refining what the syndrome is and what the etiology is. And really the biomarkers at this time, things like PET scans and CSF, and even the blood right now is really suggested to be done in a specialty setting because of both requiring having that high index of suspicion and also because of the nuance in interpretation. An amyloid PET doesn't tell you the same things as spinal fluid, for example, or the recently approved blood biomarker, which is a p-tau217 divided by a-beta-42 ratio. So those still require some nuance and specialist interpretation. But a lot can still be done in primary care. And really the point is that this has to be a partnership, that it's patient-centered, person-centered, along with a care partner, having a partnership between primary care and specialty care. And that involves more than just a neurologist or a geriatrician or a geriatric psychiatrist, but potentially neuropsychology should be optimally in the team, social work, having the advocacy groups, Alzheimer's Association, things like that. It's not easy, but this is something that we've made a lot of strides, and we want to empower patients and clinicians to ask for these things and do these things because it is possible to accurately diagnose, Alzheimer's disease and other related conditions during life using this process.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Autry. There's obviously been a good deal of evolution in the evaluation and workup of patients with cognitive deficits, and I'm glad we could talk through some of it today. And thank you for all the work you do in this area to bring the best possible care to those with Alzheimer's disease and other related dementias. But that's all the time we have today. Thanks again, Dr. Autry, for taking time out of your day to speak with us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you're able to tune into the other podcast in this series in which we'll explore some of the more recent treatment options for early Alzheimer's disease. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.